For a while, we were getting the parts on 30 days credit with no money, and we built the computers in 10 days and sold them for cash at the bike shop. Trip Hawkins. The bike shop was the first of the chain computer stores. In the bike shop, basically you've got a whole bunch of card tables set up that had a bunch of circuit boards on it and a bunch of really smelly, geeky people talking jargon. Steve Wozniak. So that was how we ran for, you know, a good year with the Apple I computer. Trip Hawkins. It was not really a commercial product. It was a kit. They only made maybe 150 of those. Al Alcorn. Mostly made with parts from Atari, by the way. Nolan Bushnell. It was considered okay for people to do their own projects with Atari parts. We wanted engineers to work on their own projects, and we were happy to subsidize that. Randy Wigginton. While Woz was doing the Apple I, he also started thinking about how he could do color graphics, because what he always wanted to do from the very beginning was to write Breakout on his own computer at home. Steve Wozniak. Back when I designed Breakout for Atari I, I was so tired, in and out of sleep. But you know what? That makes your mind creative. There was a TV set on the factory floor. They only used black and white TVs for their games, and this TV set wasn't playing a game, but it had a dot going from left to right and right to left. And as it moved, it was changing colors. Red, green, blue, yellow. There must have been a Mylar overlay or something. I couldn't see it. And I just went back to my lab bench, and so I'm just sitting there thinking, color. It was hypnotizing. Like a psychedelic light show or something at a concert. Dan Kottke. Something about the fuzzy colors in his blurred vision made him think about how if you shift the phase of the dot clock, it would cause different colors, which is true. Steve Wozniak. And here an idea popped into my head, a little way to put out a repeating digital signal of ones and zeros, 1100. It goes up and it goes down. If you think about it, ones are up and zeros are down. Up and down, up and down. It's not a sine wave, but I know how televisions work. They are going to interpret the signal as red. And if I put the ones and zeros in at a slightly different point in time, they are going to call it blue. Oh my God, I have 16 different colors. Would it work? There had never been a book that ever talked about creating color digitally. It wasn't allowed. It wasn't done. Dan Kottke. Color television was new and expensive then, and it wasn't like you could read Popular Electronics explaining how it worked. Steve Wozniak. I knew the analog world of color televisions well, but I had crossed over to the digital world. Andy Hertzfeld. Woz just kind of tuned the Apple II to the frequencies that the television worked on, such that it was synchronous with the color burst signal, the signal that tells the TV what color to display. Lee Felsenstein. You are supposed to look at color as a two-dimensional vector of the same frequency with a phase relationship. That's an analog way to look at it. When you look at it on the oscilloscope, it looks like a series of pulses, which ultimately is an approximation of a sine wave. Shifting it a little bit relative to another series of pulses gives it the color. Woz had looked at color as sort of a bit stream. So what he did was do that sine wave with digital data and shift it with hardware. And you know, everybody's jaw dropped, and we thought, my God, I guess you can do that. It was really spare, sparse, and very imaginative. Steve Wozniak. Two little parts, maybe 25 cents worth of parts. And it almost converts a square wave into a sine wave. Andy Hertzfeld. It was like a magic trick, getting color for free, just by a sort of alignment with color TV technology. And once I saw that, I thought, boy, there is genius at work here. Randy Wigginton. When he first started showing it at the home brew meetings, people were amazed, because it was like this little tiny board running things. Steve Wozniak. Color in those days was very complicated, analog stuff. Hardware circuits with feedback and resistors and capacitors and inductors. Andy Hertzfeld. It was an incredible advance, cost-wise, because to get a computer monitor to do that would have cost as much as the rest of the computer, pretty much. But Woz designed it to use a standard color television set, which could be gotten very cheaply. Steve Wozniak. It made it possible for a little $1 chip to generate color, instead of a $1,000 color generation board. Lee Felsenstein. Nobody had to pay for that additional hardware to do all that vector generation and phasing and so forth. Andy Hertzfeld. It was the single cleverest thing in the Apple II. That was one of the first revolutions. Steve Wozniak. And then I thought, I wonder if I can write a game that's playable with my slow BASIC. Dan Kotke. A video game has to move fast. Maybe the BASIC was fast enough, but most video games would not be written in BASIC. Steve Wozniak. I had done Breakout for Atari. I knew Breakout. Would it be fast enough or would it be too slow? Because BASIC is a slow language. And I wrote a little program and put in a bunch of bricks and color. And I changed the color of them, and I changed the color, and I changed the color 20 times, till I had what I liked. And then I programmed in a little paddle that would move up and down as you turn the knob. I built paddle hardware into the Apple II deliberately for the game of Breakout. I wanted everything in there. I put in a speaker with sound, so I could have beeps, like games need. Andy Hertzfeld. For the Apple II, you could write programs that played music, but it had no real sound hardware. All you could do with the software was hit a memory address, which I still remember, C030. So if you hit C030, it would produce a click on the speaker. That was all the hardware could do. But if you did that 1,000 times a second with software, you'd get a 1 kilohertz tone. If you did it 3,000 times a second, you'd get 3 kilohertz. And the Apple II was literally full of stuff like that, whereby just using tiny little bits of resources, it could do amazing stuff. In fact, just looking at the Apple II design gave you the feeling that anything was possible, if you were just clever enough. That's what the main lesson of the Apple II is, that it had infinite horizons. Steve Wozniak. So I programmed Breakout, and in half an hour I had tried 100 variations that would have taken me 10 years in hardware if I could have even done it.
So I called Steve Jobs over to my apartment, and we sat down on the floor next to the cable snaking into my TV that had the back off of it so I could get the wires inside.
And I showed him how I could change the colors of things and change the shape of the paddle. And change the speed of the balls. So easy. And he and I looked at each other, and we were both kind of shaking, because we knew that the world of games was never going to be the same, now that they were software. I mean, up until then, there were no software games in the arcades. But we now knew that animated games were going to be software. Oh my God, a fifth grader could program in BASIC and make games like Breakout. This was going to be a new world. We saw it right then. Al Alcorn. Jobs was telling me he's going to get this thing funded and all that, and he said, well, I want to pitch it to Atari. To you guys. I said, well, I'm not the one to do this. I pointed him to Joe Keenan. Joe was the serious, level-headed businessman. Nolan would probably just say yes, just because he couldn't say no. And anyhow, he couldn't focus on this. And basically, the meeting did not go well.
Jobs came out, and how'd it go?
Not too good. Joe had basically kicked him out of the office for misbehaving. You just don't put your bare feet on a guy's desk. Joe was, you know, Joe was a great guy, but Steve was barefoot. And this was just too much. This was like, jeez. Steve Wozniak. The story of Apple is a little misunderstood. It's not like Steve and I did it ourselves. Al Alcorn. We helped them get the account to get the 6502 microprocessor. Remember, these kids were like 18 or 19 years old. They can't get a credit card, let alone a trade account and a credit account. They'd show up and say, "Al, they won't talk to me." Of course not. You're a high school kid. You know, they've got a business to do. And I said, "Well, I tell you what, I'll put in the word to my friend." And I said, "Talk to these kids. They've got something cute and they'll go somewhere." He said, "Okay."
I get a call back a couple of weeks later saying that was the funniest meeting he's ever had.
"What? What happened?" He said, "Well, these two kids, Steve Jobs and this Wozniak, come in. They were trying to get parts from us, and they got no accounts. No trade accounts, no references. And Jobs not only is trying to get an account, he's trying to negotiate a great price. And Woz is trying to tell him, just go get an account. Let's just take the parts and worry about that later. Jobs is trying to get Woz to shut up." So Jobs tries to hit Woz under the table, and Jobs slides off the chair because he's so thin. And he falls under the conference room table, and they have to pull him out. "Okay, tell you what, we'll give you a 90-day account, and if you don't pay, you're cut off, okay?" "Okay." That was the biggest account they ever had. Steve Wozniak. A guy funded us, an angel, and he joined us. He had made his money working in marketing at Intel and as an engineer before, and he was a mentor. He was kind of young, but he was wealthy, and he owned as much of Apple as Steve and I did. Same amount of stock. Mike Markula was his name. Mike Markula. The two of them did not make a good impression on people. They were bearded, they didn't smell good, they dressed funny. Young, naive. Arthur Rock. Mike asked me if I'd be interested in investing in Apple Computer, and I met with Jobs and Wozniak, and I really didn't think I wanted to be involved with them. Steve Jobs had just returned from 6 months in India with a guru, or whatever you call them, and they didn't appear very well, and they were bragging about the blue box they had invented to steal money from the telephone companies. And I didn't like that too much. Mike Markula. But Woz had designed a really wonderful computer. Al Alcorn. That was the trouble with starting a company when you're under 21. You're underage. You can't drink, but you can start a company. The fledgling company made its first big splash in 1977 at the inaugural West Coast Computer Fair, which, like the mother of all demos a decade before, was held at Brooks Hall and San Francisco's Civic Center. The confab was a coming-out party for the talented backers of the Homebrew Computer Club, and Apple was just one company out of perhaps a half-dozen homebrew hopefuls. Jim Warren. I didn't know anything about producing a computer convention. I got on the phone and started calling people. Because I had been editor of Dr. Dobbs' Journal of Tiny Basic Calisthenics and Orthodontia, to say nothing of being very active in homebrew, I knew all of the owners and founders of the startup companies. So I called them up. "Oh, yeah, we really want to exhibit in that. Oh, yeah, that would be wonderful." I called up Steve Jobs. "Hey, we're doing this fair. Hey, I want you to be in on that. We want the front of the hall right at the main entrance." "Okay, send me some money." "Sure. How much do you need?" "Okay, those are going to be high-priced. Why don't you send me this much?" "Sure, it will be in the mail." Andy Hertzfeld. I remember walking into the West Coast Computer Fair. I was impressed with just how many people were there. Randy Wigginton. There were thousands of people walking around. People who were more, I should say, free thinkers. Because it wasn't mainstream. It was a lot of just hobbyists and people who had heard something about it. It was more of a counterculture event than I think you would expect. Steve Jobs. In the first several years of Apple, we were selling to people just like us. Randy Wigginton. The industry had no direction. It was just sort of growing like mold, just sort of popping up. Nobody knew what was going to win, what was going to lose, what the direction was going to be. Nobody knew about Apple, for sure. Al Alcorn. I remember thinking, all those poor bastards making computers nobody's going to buy. And nobody did, except for the Apple II. Andy Hertzfeld. Somehow, like a magnet, I was just drawn to the Apple booth. Randy Wigginton. Steve was so proud of that booth. I mean, he just thought it was the greatest thing ever. I mean, he couldn't stop talking about it. You know, he was so proud of the whole sign, how beautiful it was, how it looked professional, and how he was going to make us look better than everyone else. That was just totally his baby. Because, I mean, honestly, at that point in the company, we had no idea what to do with Steve. Steve was just a pain. He would try to negotiate with vendors. Ah, I think you need to go sharpen your pencil. It was code for give me a better price. Woz and I were making fun of him all the time for that, but he really found his calling developing the booth. Lee Felsenstein. The Apple booth had a projection color display. No one else had that. And that projector said it all. You guys can play around with your little alphanumeric terminals and so forth. We got color graphics on the base product, and a lot of people got interested in that. Their booth was crowded. Steve Wozniak. That, bringing color to the world. You're not in Kansas anymore. That's why we chose the six-color logo. We were the ones that rocked color because nobody would have ever expected color on an affordable computer, much less the graphics that we had. We even had pixels, so you could almost have photographs on the screen. No, it was so far ahead of its time that everybody else was going to have to sit back and figure out ways to do it. Trip Hawkins. It had a bunch of innovative features. It had the bitmapped graphics, it had the color. It had a really crappy little speaker, and it could make a few beeping noises. That was about it. But a lot of machines didn't even do that. Andy Hertzfeld. I could tell right away there was something magical about it. Part of it, I guess, was the look of the case. Al Miller. I remember Jobs standing up at a homebrew meeting holding the very first plastic case. Somehow that symbolized an advancement, a move into the mainstream. Trip Hawkins. It looked fabulous compared to all the other junk. I mean, if you'd asked a bunch of women at that time, okay, which of these would you tolerate having at your house? They would say the Apple II, and they would look at all the others and go, that stuff is really hideously ugly. It was all this sort of geeky, hardcore-looking stuff. And then the Apple II was this beautiful thing. Andy Hertzfeld. At that point, all the other ones were rectangular metal boxes that looked like they were industrial equipment. The message was, oh, that means it's not for people. They were for manufacturing or business or something, but they didn't give off an inviting feeling, whereas the Apple II looked beautiful. It kind of looked like a futuristic typewriter. Trip Hawkins. Oddly enough, Steve made a mistake there because he had a choice between a character generator ROM chip that did a traditional upper and lowercase characters set, and he went instead for one that was all uppercase, either regular or inverse, or flashing inverse. You could do that too. So our first generation word processors looked like hell. Alan Kay. But Apple was starting to get interesting. Not because there was anything interesting about the Apple II. The thing that was really interesting was the spreadsheet. Steve Wozniak. VisiCalc was the killer app. Alan Kay. We had almost invented the spreadsheet at Xerox PARC, but none of us were businesslike enough. All of us, when we saw the spreadsheet, we thought it was just the best damn thing, just fabulous. Charles Simonyi. My jaw dropped. Wow. Here is this primitive machine, and it's doing something we were just dreaming of, just kind of hinting at. This is big. If you can do this with this machine, imagine what you could do on a more serious machine, like the Alto, or the machines that were coming. Chuck Thacker. VisiCalc was a thing that was useful to business people, and a lot of them, and did increase the productivity of people who did use that kind of tool. Enormously. Butler Lampson. It was the success of the Apple II and VisiCalc that created the whole personal computer industry, really. Steve Wozniak. The Apple II was the only one of those computers, the three of them that existed, that had enough memory to run VisiCalc. So they had to write it for this computer only. Everybody else had to go back to the drawing board and make computers that could add floppy disks and more memory. So that was a big leap for us. It was an accident, too. We hadn't really thought about how we were going to make sure that we were well ahead of the competition. We just lucked out. Andy Hertzfeld. By the fall of 79, VisiCalc was making Apple sales triple every month. Trip Hawkins. VisiCalc was the number one driver. Word processing was the number two driver. And that was a pretty potent 1-2 punch. John Markoff. The Apple II was about getting out of the hobbyist ghetto and making personal computing accessible to the broader world. At its peak, the Apple II was sold through Macy's, and a lot of the big marketing push early was educational, in the sense that this was an intellectual activity that you could give to your kids. Clive Thompson. The Apple II was the first time that computers went really mass market. It was this moment when those great big huge room-scale computers suddenly shrunk down and got into the hands of teenagers. And the moment anything gets put in the hands of teenagers, it becomes part of mass culture. That's a tripwire moment. That's what happened to the car in the 50s and 60s. It was the computer in the late 70s and 80s, and the Apple II was the vanguard machine. Steve Jobs. The Apple II went on to sell maybe 10 million units over its lifetime. It was the first really successful personal computer by a mile. Towel designers. Atari's high-strung prima donnas. At about the same time that Woz realized that the new low-cost microprocessors would make his dream of a personal computer a reality, Alcorn and the others up in Atari's product development group realized that they could use the same chips to power a new kind of machine, a home video game console with a slot on top, in which one could plug in game cartridges. The Atari VCS, later to be renamed the Atari 2600, brought the excitement of the arcade to America's living rooms and established a new economic model for Silicon Valley. The VCS was a platform, and the cartridges, software in essence, were a predictable revenue stream. Atari, after more than a few brushes with bankruptcy, had invented a golden goose, but there wasn't enough money to build it. Nolan Bushnell knew he had to sell. Nolan Bushnell. We'd been on this ride that was almost vertical, and I just knew that if you keep pushing all your chips out in the middle, at some point you're going to lose your stack. And you're not just gambling with your own future, you're gambling with the future of all the people that are working for you. The number of times that I didn't have the cash on Wednesday for payroll on Friday. I can remember one time I had 9 uncashed paychecks personally. We had been running the company with tricks and mirrors from a cash standpoint, and it was very clear that the launch of the VCS was going to consume a massive amount of capital. I think I was tired. Al Alcorn. We actually had a prospectus for a public offering, but the market went bad so we couldn't do that, and then we had to look for a buyer. Nolan Bushnell. And then Manny Girard from Warner said that the chairman, Steve Ross, had been with his kids to Disneyland and played Atari games for a full afternoon. He came and kind of kicked the tires and looked around a little bit and said, "We'll send the jet." I'd never been on a private jet before. I climbed up into this G2 and they said, "We hope you don't mind, but we're going to have to stop in Sun Valley and pick up another guest." Clint Eastwood. So all of a sudden, we're feeling like really big shits. There were 4 of us on the team, and after we land in New York, we get picked up by a limousine and swept off to the Waldorf Towers. Not just the Waldorf Towers. It was a 9-room suite that had a pool table and a grand piano. Our normal fare was Holiday Inn. They were clearly warming us up. The next day, we go up to meet Steve Ross to sort of negotiate, and we came to a handshake agreement in form and structure of the deal by probably 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon. Al Alcorn. Warner concluded the deal in November 1976. The VCS was already under development, underway. Chris Kane. This was the very beginning of the whole synergy between Hollywood and Silicon Valley. Al Alcorn. So we sell the company for $30 million to Warner, and we thought we were the richest guys in the world. Nolan Bushnell. My personal payday was about $16 million, which was considered to be a lot at that time. Al Alcorn. When I sobered up about a month later, I bought a Shelby Cobra, and I bought a house after that and an airplane. So that was my splurging. Nolan goes off and buys himself a Learjet, starts a charter operation. Nolan Bushnell. Corporate air transport. We leased jets. That was Nolan living larger than life and getting a little ahead of himself. It turns out that you cannot run a private jet economically, and getting two jets doesn't help at all. Al Alcorn. Because I was a pilot and I loved to fly, I would fly Nolan and the guys back to Grass Valley quite often. Ron Milner. Atari's secret think tank in the mountains. Al Alcorn. I go there every week. Alan Kay. Atari had a group of inventors up in Grass Valley that had been involved in the original machines. They were kind of tinkerers. Ron Milner. Their operation down in the Bay Area was so busy with production and making the stuff work that they didn't have time to develop the next new thing. Al Alcorn. My title was VP of Research and Development. That's what was actually on my business card. Well, I wasn't that. There was no R&D, per se. It was advanced product design. The tinkerers in Grass Valley were developing the VCS. The initials stood for Video Computer System. From an engineering perspective, the VCS was a personal computer much like the Apple II. It was even powered by an almost identical microprocessor. But Atari marketed it as a home video game console for the masses. Al Miller. The VCS was introduced in the fall of 77, and it was very well received. David Crane. The VCS was actually designed so that they could sell one console and then sell a tank cartridge and a Pong cartridge. Twice as many sales, right? So the hardware was designed to play those two games. And if it could do any other games, great, we can sell more cartridges. So that was the push. Let's see if we do more arcade games on this home hardware. Larry Kaplan. I saw their ad in the Mercury News and applied for the job. I was among 100 applicants. They later told me they hired me because I had purchased an Altair. I started in August of 1976. I joined Atari so I could play Breakout for free. Bob Whitehead. I was the second programmer hired at Atari. Then Alan Miller and Dave Crane came on my heels just behind me. We were all brought on to program games for this new programmable cartridge-based system. David Crane. Myself, Al Miller, Bob Whitehead, and Larry Kaplan, we generally worked together on our projects. Bob Whitehead. We weren't the only guys being hired to program these things. What seemed to happen was just a group of us began to separate ourselves professionally. It seems like a few of us just had a better knack for doing games. We became fast friends. David Crane. Larry Kaplan made Air-Sea Battle, which showed that it could do more than just tank and pong. Air-Sea Battle had two little howitzer-like guns at the bottom. One player, two player. They had fighter jets and things flying over, and you would shoot missiles at them, and there was a lot of action going on in the game. Far more action than the designers of the VCS had originally expected. Al Miller did a game called Surround, which was originally an arcade game from Atari. Bob Whitehead went off the other direction and did an original title, a baseball game where you actually batted and pitched and all that kind of stuff. I did Canyon Bomber and Depth Charge, which were ported over from the Atari arcade games. The arcade versions cost like $4,000 each. And I put them both into a VCS cartridge that you could buy for $19 and play on your little $200 machine. Al Alcorn. They were a huge hit. Warner got there at the right time. Larry Kaplan. Within a year, the company had enough money that they put in a sauna in the engineering section. We were spoiled, and we worked the hours we wanted to work, on any schedule, and a game was finished when we said it was finished. Al Alcorn. We moved to a brand new facility out in Sunnyvale next to Lockheed. Clearly the money was helping to pay for it. At first, it was the same Atari. Bob Whitehead. Atari began to change when Warner brought on Ray Kassar as CEO. Ray Kassar came from Ralph Lauren. Al Alcorn. He has never been on the West Coast. Didn't understand consumer products, electronic products. Didn't understand games or anything like that. But he was a businessman. Ray Kassar. When I arrived there on the first day, I was dressed in a business suit and tie, and I met Nolan Bushnell. He had a T-shirt on. The T-shirt said, "I love to fuck." That was my introduction to Atari. Al Alcorn. Ray had an executive parking spot for his chauffeur-driven Rolls-Royce. He had a helicopter landing pad. He had an executive dining room so the executives did not have to rub shoulders with the unwashed. It was a term they liked to use, the great unwashed. He was really tone-deaf to what was going on around him. Al Miller. I was at one of the very first meetings that Ray had with the entire group. There were probably 80 to 100 technologists in the room, and somebody asked him, "Well, what kind of experience do you have dealing with creative people?" Because, you know, we were creating entertainment. And he said, "Oh, I've had a lot of experience dealing with creative people. I've worked with towel designers my entire career. And I don't know about the other people, but I was just flabbergasted when he said that, because it showed he was entirely clueless about the industry and what we were doing." Alan Kay. Ray was a great guy and a very good businessman, but his former experience in computing was that he was an expert in Egyptian cotton. Ray Kassar. I had not played video games before. David Crane. Marketing circulated a memo, a single sheet of the sales of game cartridges for the previous year by percentage. It said number one was baseball or whatever, and it did 22% of sales. And then number two was this, and the percentage all the way down. And basically what the memo said was, here's what's selling, this is what's hot, do more like that. They had no idea what it took to make a video game, what the effort was, and how you actually enticed people to play it and make it interesting. All those things. They just wanted more. More like the top of the sales chart than the bottom. Al Alcorn. Miller, Crane, Whitehead, Kaplan. Those guys could, in 3 months, design a video game cartridge that would generate $10 to $20 million in sales. Bob Whitehead. The four of us began to look up the numbers, and we found out just the four of us were responsible for in excess of $200 million in sales. Just our games. That was after a year and a half or so of sales. David Crane. Since we went out to lunch together and tended to look at these things together, we totaled up the sales of all the games that we did. And that was interesting, because about 60% of the total sales from the previous year were games that the four of us did. 20% of the revenues from the previous year were people who had left Atari just to go off and do other things. And of the 30 people left, they accounted for about 20% of the revenue. Al Miller. And so I researched the music and the book publishing industries to develop a contract that I thought would be fair for my situation at Atari. And I submitted it to my management, saying this is the kind of relationship I want. I want recognition for my work, and I proposed something like a 2 or 3% commission royalty, which was pretty low relative to the music and the book publishing industry. And I started having discussions with my management, and then it bopped up to senior management, Ray. David Crane. We went into Ray Kassar's office, and we told them all about it. Al Alcorn. They said, "Well, come on, give us a piece." They didn't want a lot, just 5 cents a cartridge. David Crane. We said, "Look, obviously there's something that we have that is marketable, that makes value." Clive Thompson. One of the things that are so interesting about those early games is how they wrestled with the great geopolitical anxieties of the times. Not just global thermonuclear war, but also the idea that society was robotizing. Space Invaders was about these gibbering creatures from the id, You had games that literally made the subtext text, like Missile Command. Games were responding to these floating senses of technological threat that were in the air. There was really something dreamlike about them. They were the poetry of the age. Al Miller. We were doing creative efforts, much like book authors. In that era, it was single-person work. We did all the music. We did all the art. We did all the programming. We did virtually all of the conceptual design as well. Chris Kane. You gotta remember that back then you had one software programmer per product. It's not like the world now where you have hundreds of programmers working on a decade-long plan to deliver a single software experience. Howard Warshaw. Programming created this new phenomenon. The intellectual blue-collar workers that are as smart or smarter than the managers who are working with them. Ray and his staff weren't prepared to deal with this. Al Alcorn. Ray's attitude was that the engineers were a bunch of high-strung prima donnas. David Crane. And he said, well, you know, this is a corporate product. It's an engineering product. There are hundreds of employees at Atari, and if that guy over there didn't do his job, we wouldn't have sold $60 million. If that guy over there didn't do his job, we wouldn't have sold $60 million. In fact, if the guy on the assembly line hadn't put them together, we wouldn't have made $60 million on the games. So, you are actually no more important than the guy on the assembly line who puts them together. That was the end of that meeting. And in fact, we were walked out by a senior vice president who just kind of chuckled at the way that meeting went and said, well, guys, it's been nice knowing you, because he knew that we'd be gone soon. Chris Kane. The idea that people would leave Atari to go start their own software company was baffling to the powers that be. It would have been like leaving Ford to start Edsel. Why would anyone do that? Bob Whitehead. We were starting to say, you know what? Enough is enough. We're not respected here. We can definitely make some big money elsewhere in the new emerging game business. And so we decided the easiest thing to do was write games in BASIC, the programming language BASIC. So one of us says, I know a guy over at Wilson Sonsini. They were a pretty well-respected Silicon Valley law group. Jim Levy, the mother church of venture law. Bob Whitehead. We went over and had a meeting, and one of the lawyers says, you know what, I'm talking to a guy named Jim Levy who's kind of doing the same thing. He's from the music business, and he's been working with a group that has been distributing BASIC games and talking about splitting that off and starting his own company. David Crane. He said, you need to talk to this guy because you guys have all the technical expertise, but you don't have the business experience. So he's going to be your CEO. Jim Levy. So these guys pull up out in front of my house about 2 in the afternoon. They pile out of this car, and they're all really young. I think the oldest was 30, Larry Kaplan. But Al Miller, Bob Whitehead, David Crane, we're all like 23, 24, or 25, somewhere in there. I wasn't that much older. I was 34 at the time. So they sit down and start explaining to me what they do. I had seen arcade games, and I think I had brushed up against things like Pong and so forth, but I hadn't really seen or taken notice of the cartridge programmable system, the VCS. Clive Thompson. The Atari VCS games were definitely the rock and roll for that generation. It was a deep and intense culture for the kids. Bob Whitehead. Well, it wasn't very long with our meeting with Jim where we started asking each other cool questions. It could have been prompted even by Jim himself. Why can't we just do Atari games? Cartridges. Jim Levy. So they said, do you realize Atari has 1 million-plus systems out there, and they are the only ones doing software for it? I said, oh, okay. They said, so would you consider doing your startup, but starting with video games, Atari-compatible games instead of personal computer software? And I said, well, that's an interesting idea. Tell me more. Bob Whitehead. Within a pretty short period of time, Jim put together a business plan. David Crane. It all went pretty quickly after that. Al Alcorn. Those kids went off with a lot of energy and a lot of venom and started a company. David Crane, we ended up getting venture capital funding and forming Activision in 1979. Clive Thompson, there were video games before the VCS. There were arcade games. But once games became things that you could play over and over again while sitting in your basement, there was a new economic logic. An arcade game wanted you to lose after about 2 minutes so that you would put another quarter in. But once a game became something that you could buy and take home with you, it created a different relationship with the game. You could explore a game that was longer and richer. So you started getting these games where you had to go roaming around and find things and complete this quest. It became storytelling. David Crane. Programming for the VCS was the greatest technical challenge that has ever existed in video games. My goal was to do a game with an actual human figure in it. Back at the time, your main character was a tank or a jet airplane. Creating a realistic-looking person was very difficult, and I would walk around the lab and freeze my motion and sketch where my legs were. Animators do that sort of thing. They often use themselves as models for their animation. And I would do that for hours and hours on end until I had a pretty nice character. Jim Levy. David was really a computer animator and still is. David Crane. I said, okay, there's my little running man. What's he doing? Well, he's running. He's probably running on a path. So I drew two lines that represented a path. Where is this path? Let's put it in a jungle. I drew some trees. And why is he running? I put threats, treasures to collect, that sort of thing, and figured out these quicksand and tar pits and alligator heads to jump over, and just tied a bunch of this stuff together. And really, I had a sketch in about 10 minutes, which defined the whole game. Jim Levy. Pitfall made David a rock star. Pitfall was our Space Invaders. It was a landmark game that had spin-offs. Saturday morning cartoon shows and an arcade game. I think it was the first time that a home game had spun out to the arcades instead of the reverse. David Crane. Pitfall took me about 1,000 hours sitting at a computer to do. Now that's a long time, except it's only a few months. 6 or 7 months. And it turns out that Pitfall earned Activision $50 million wholesale. So I made for them $50,000 an hour, given the 1,000 hours I worked on it. Jim Levy. The party for Pitfall was spectacular. David Crane. Live animals hanging in cages from the ceiling in the jungle theme. 3 live bands, a marimba band just in the entryway before you got into one of the 3 ballrooms. Those parties, everyone in the industry and then some would come. We'd have 4,000 people coming to a party at Activision. Those were good times. Larry Kaplan. Activision was so flush with cash, the programmers were traveling first class, had limousine service, company cars, a private chef, and a Do Not Disturb sign on the door and the phone. Activision, one of Silicon Valley's earliest software companies, made millionaires and celebrities out of its programmer founders. Meanwhile, things were starting to go downhill at Atari. Al Miller. Atari just dropped the ball because senior management did not understand the technology. They had pissed off the really capable people. Nolan Bushnell. What we were planning was a network for playing games online. It was going to be very simple. We were going to have a closet full of computers in every area code, because in those days a local call was free, but long distance was very expensive. And then we were going to link the closets with a T1 line. Now, when you think about that, that's fundamentally the architecture of the Internet. Our IP stack was very, very similar to the Internet's IP stack. And that was killed. Now think about if Atari owned the Internet. That would have been massively cool. Al Alcorn. There was a fear of introducing new products that might fail. even though we were making the billions of dollars, and if it failed, it wouldn't even be a blemish. It would be just nothing. But to a big corporation, it was, what if we introduced this thing and everyone laughed at us? Thus, if we don't introduce this thing, they won't laugh at us. So that was going on. It was clear that Atari was not going to release any new products. Nolan Bushnell. They started killing off the projects that we were working on because every prototype looked like a tiny business to them, not realizing that all businesses at the outset looked like tiny businesses. They just thought they were geniuses. You know, it was just a corporate culture that became very toxic. Al Alcorn. So Nolan and I go off. Well, actually, Nolan goes off first. Nolan left in 80, I left in 81, and we were just going to start a bunch of companies. Nolan Bushnell. I had a lot of ideas for businesses that were somewhat disparate, and so I got a facility, centralized Xerox machines, centralized healthcare. The idea was that if I funded an engineer to do something, they could go in, get a key, a stack of papers on their desk, sign their name 64 times, and within 45 minutes they'd be incorporated. They'd have payroll set up and be working on their project without all this other noise. Catalyst was the first incubator. It was absolutely unique at the time. Stan Honey. Upstairs at Catalyst, Nolan had a great big office suite and this enormous desk that had computer screens buried in it. The feeling of it was kind of tablet-like. It was a prediction of things to come. Pretty interesting. Nolan has always been involved in a ton of stuff. Nolan Bushnell. I did automobile navigation. I did this kiosk project called Bivideo, which was the first online shopping kiosk. I had a toy company. I had a little robotics company, and life was good. The most notable spin-out was ETAC, the world's first commercially available computerized in-car navigation system. Bushnell sold ETAC to Rupert Murdoch for $30 million, the same price that Warner had paid for Atari. Al Alcorn. So now Ray was beginning to learn a lesson, but he overlearned it, and now he's trying to coddle the engineers. The office was too noisy or whatever, and so they had to have a facility over at Santa Cruz or something. Steve Perlman. I was an Atari intern. I remember going to the office where the software engineers were. I had to ask them something, I don't remember what, so I knocked on the door and I heard from outside a voice say, "Who is it?" I say, "It's Steve, the summer intern." The voice says, "He's cool, man, let him in." So they open the door and let me in, and blue smoke just comes flowing out. Howard Warshaw. There was a lot of dope that was smoked at Atari when we were there. Steve Perlman. They're passing around a joint, and the guy says, "Steve, I call this my number 7. Do you know why?" And I say, "Why?" He says, "Well, it's got 3 bits in it. It's Maui Wowie with hash dunked in hash oil." If you know binary, 7 is 111. 3 bits in binary. I'm like, great, cool. I can understand how that can help with your creativity, but I've got work to do. Al Alcorn. And toward the end, Ray got Larry Kaplan to jump ship from Activision and come back to Atari. He was going to run engineering, at least get the cartridges done. Larry was the first manager that could read the code, and he could see these guys were doing nothing. They were just goofing off, getting money, and nobody could assess them. So Larry came back and told them, he said, "You've got to start firing people." "Oh, no, we can't fire them. Look, they're out of control. They're not doing anything. We've got to show them who is boss because they don't take orders." And Ray wouldn't let him do it. So I think Larry gave up at that point. Larry Kaplan. "I left to start a game hardware company to build a replacement for the VCS, since no one had done anything comparable." Al Miller. At Activision, we kept waiting. When is Atari going to introduce their next great game machine? And they never did. Alan Kay. Atari was greedy, and they were making a shitload of money off really obsolete games toward the end there. Al Alcorn. You know, in Silicon Valley, if you don't obsolete yourself, somebody else will, right? The Warner guys didn't really understand that. They were from an East Coast company and thought that they had an evergreen kind of product. They thought that they would just sit back and mint money for the rest of their lives, selling the Atari VCS for the next 20 years. Park opens the kimono. Good artists copy. Great artists steal. The Apple II, which was designed in order to play Breakout at home, found its greatest success with businessmen who bought it to play with spreadsheets at work. Seeing this, Jobs concluded that Apple needed to turn away from games and reorient itself around the needs of business. The next computer should be an office of the future machine. But what did that mean exactly? The answer came when Jobs went to Xerox Park to see the Alto. In December 1979, Jobs was ushered into the ivory tower to get the full demo and more. He saw the laser printer, networking, and something called object-oriented programming. But what impressed Jobs most about the Alto was the mouse. He was 24 at the time, too young to have attended Engelbart's mother-of-all demos, but he fixated on the mouse, which was Engelbart's most fundamental breakthrough. With the mouse, one could point and click, cut and paste, doodle and paint. It was the key to the virtual desktop on the Alto's screen, the office of the future. After seeing what Park had invented, Jobs knew exactly what he had to do. Bruce Horn. Bob Taylor's group at Park was CSL, the Computer Science Lab. That group was very computer science heavy. Real heavy hitters in the field, in the industry. Bob Taylor. The people in CSL despised Steve Jobs. To a person. Steve Jobs was a college dropout who didn't know shit about computing. The CSL people were PhDs in computer science. Alan Kay. The reason that the homebrew type stuff works is because some guys with PhDs put a lot of complicated electrical engineering into the chips. Bob Taylor. We laughed at his Apple II. Compared to an Alto, it was laughable. Alvy Ray Smith. I knew this hobbyist stuff was happening. There were people at Xerox Park saying, Alvy, you've got to come over to the garage. But I just didn't give a damn. I was like, was it just toys? Larry Tesler. I went to homebrew computer club meetings, and I was telling everybody that Xerox is going to miss the boat unless we get into this. This is really taking off. Xerox headquarters got concerned, and a guy named Roy Lahr in the business development group in East Coast Xerox headquarters came out to Park. He said, we have a task force. We're going to study these personal computers. We're going to come to some decision about what the company should do, and we want your input. But the decision is going to be made by the management of the company. So we all gave input. And as he went around meeting people, he found that there were three or four of us that thought personal computers were going to happen, and that Xerox couldn't wait until Park came out with something. And they wrote up their findings and recommended that they, in fact, partner with somebody like Apple to get into this market. And so they came up with a deal where Xerox would be allowed to invest in Apple. John Couch. Steve said, well, you know, if you open the kimono of Xerox Park, we'll let you invest. It was really an exchange of favors. Larry Tesler. Apple would be allowed to see some Park technology, which they've heard of from the graduate students that they'd hired from various places. And Park would help Apple to do the kind of hardware they were doing with mice and bitmap displays and so on. They would give a limited amount of technical help and more sourcing help, help them find manufacturers who would make things like the mouse for them. And Xerox's view was this would be a benefit to Xerox. Alan Kay. By 79, we had shown this system to about 3,000 people. Why did Steve Jobs decide he wanted to go there? His people had seen the demo and they just wanted Steve to see it. Adele Goldberg. Mind you, they could have come at the once-a-month demo day if they wanted to, but they wanted a special visit. So Xerox closed off the foyer, and they set up a machine up there. Alan Kay. There was a table with their display console and stuff, and the demo was given. Adele Goldberg. It was given by Dan Ingalls and Larry Tesler with me in attendance. Alan Kay. And our typical way of doing things is pilot-co-pilot things where people trade off. And Steve was sitting to the left and a couple of his people were there. Adele and I were standing in the back of the room watching this. Adele Goldberg. In fact, it wasn't one demo, it was two demos. They were maybe a week apart, but you've got to separate these because they were very different. The first demo was a management demo. So this was, look at multimedia as built on the Smalltalk system. Smalltalk was Alan Kay's revolutionary object-oriented programming environment that was developed at Park for the Alto. Thanks to the Alto's bitmapped graphics capability, Smalltalk was the first system to have a full-blown graphical user interface, or GUI, a feature that proved to be very influential. Dan Ingalls. I gave a demo in which I was sort of showing off the programming environment. Alan Kay. It was kind of like what we have today, but better. It was a completely integrated system that was not made up of applications, but objects that you could mix and match anywhere. You've got a work area, and you can bring every object in the system, and you just start. You've got every tool. You've got every object. And you can make new objects. It was programmable by end users, and it had the famous GUI. Larry Tesler. It was the first one that was graphically based. Overlapping windows, a mouse, stuff like that. Adele Goldberg. It was very much a GUI demo. Dan Ingalls. I was scrolling up some text and Steve said, I really like this display. Alan Kay. At that time, when text scrolled, it did so discreetly. So jump, 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 like that. Dan Ingalls. And Jobs said, would it be possible to scroll that up smoothly? Alan Kay. Can you do it continuously? Steve liked to pull people's chains. Dan Ingalls. Because it did look a little bit jerky, you know? Alan Kay. So Dan, or maybe Larry, just opened up a Smalltalk window and... Bruce Horn. Changed a few lines of code in Smalltalk, and in the blink of an eye, it could do a smooth scroll. Alan Kay. And so it was like, bingo. And so Steve was impressed. But he didn't know enough to be really impressed. The other Apple people just shit in their pants when they saw this. It was just the best, best thing I've seen. Dan Ingalls. I think that sort of blew Steve's mind. Certainly just about anybody who worked on development systems responded really well to that particular demonstration. It really showed how the Smalltalk system could be changed on the fly and be extremely malleable in terms of stuff you could try out in the user interface. Alan Kay. On Smalltalk, you could change any part of the system in a quarter of a second. These days it's called live coding, but most of the stuff today, and virtually everything back then, used compiled code. So your programming and editing and stuff like that was a completely separate thing. You had to stop the system and rebuild. Dan Ingalls. So you had a regular sort of programming environment sitting there in front of you with windows and menus and the ability to look at code and stuff. But the neat thing about it was that if you edited the code, it would actually change the code that you were running at that very moment. The object-oriented architecture made it really, really quick to make changes. Bruce Horn. Even today, if you wanted to change something at the level of the operating system in Mac OS or Windows, it's simply impossible unless they've decided to give you that option, to smooth scroll or not. It's simply impossible to get to the source code to do that, unless you're an employee. And even then, it would probably take 6 months to get that feature in. Whereas within Smalltalk, you can pop up the menus, accept the change, and it's working right now. You can't even do that today. Larry Tesler. We were very proud of that, being in the Smalltalk group. Bruce Horn. So long story short, that was a blinding insight for Steve. Oh my God, this object-oriented programming stuff that Park has is super powerful. He saw that power. Larry Tesler. Steve was just really focused on the UI and the way it looked, the simplicity and the beauty of it. Steve Jobs.